This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting Aspen Public Radio in Colorado for the Aspen Ideas Festival. We have heard a lot about civility this week. Last week, White House advisor Stephen Miller was called a fascist while dining at a Mexican restaurant in Washington. 2 days after that, a protest targeted Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen at another Mexican restaurant in the area. And 2 days after that, White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders was asked to leave a small restaurant in Lexington, Virginia. No, not a Mexican restaurant. But that string of incidents has prompted a fiery debate about civility in the public discourse. Some say incivility has really always been wrapped up in American politics in one way or another, and that it is an acceptable form of dissent. Others see an alarming trend. What is the relationship between civility and politics? And where do you draw the line? We asked you for your thoughts on this matter. Lots of you left us messages. Here is some of what you left in our inbox.
This is Janine calling from Skagit County, Washington.
This is Adam Hall calling from Durham, North Carolina.
I believe that these calls to harass Trump supporters and the Trump administration are way off base.
It seems to me like this type of behavior is the only thing that conservatives actually understand.
I am a proud liberal Democrat, and I get angry, of course, but I do not think that harassment and anger even are the answer.
Think about the number of people, women, for example, who have been verbally berated and harassed at a Planned Parenthood, or what same-sex couples have had to put up with from conservatives who are opposed to marriage equality.
I think that listening to the facts and reacting with your vote are the answer.
It seems to me like this is a perfectly reasonable way to be handling it.
I don't think that we need to keep fueling anger from the other side.
It's really the only language they actually understand.
Just a cycle.
Four guests to help us discuss this for the hour. Steve Clemens is here with us at Aspen Public Radio. He's the Washington editor-at-large at The Atlantic. Steve, welcome to 1A.
Good to be with you.
Christine Fair is an associate professor at Georgetown University's Security Studies program. You may remember we've had Christine on before because last year she confronted white nationalist Richard Spencer at her gym. Christine, good to talk to you again. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Carolyn Lukensmeyer is the executive director of the National Institute for Civil Discourse. She joins us from our home base in Washington. Carolyn, thanks for making time for us.
Happy to be with you again.
And Todd Gitlin is a former student protest leader and professor of journalism and sociology at Columbia University. Todd, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot.
I wonder if we can work our way around the panel just briefly and get your quick 10-second definitions of what civility is. I feel like we each kicked that term around a little bit, and everyone's got a slightly different definition. Just briefly, quickly, we'll get into more detail as our conversation goes on, but Carolyn, maybe we start with you. What is civility? Give me your quick 10-second definition.
Civility is the ability to exchange views with respect with someone who thinks completely differently than you do on an important issue.
Todd Gitlin, what about you? What is civility to you?
Sign on to Carolyn's definition.
Christine Fair, what's civility to you?
I'll sign on to her definition as well, but I'll also make the intervention that I cannot respect a racist. I cannot respect someone that thinks that just because I'm a female, I'm a lesser person, or that because someone is not a Christian or a white male. And I think this is the crux of the problem. How can I speak civilly to someone who rejects my foundational equality as a human being?
Steve Clemens, what is civility to you?
I think civility is like a lubricant between people and issues that are not the same. Civility automatically implies that you're sitting down with people of different perspective, of different background, you know, of different ingredients in terms of what they care about and what they're pursuing. And civility allows us a moment to meet, work together, and move on, but it doesn't change either side.
Steve, let me stick with you. I think one of the things that kind of heated up this debate this week had to do with the comments of Congresswoman Maxine Waters, Democrat from California. She waded into this debate this week. During a protest in Los Angeles, she urged protesters to literally keep getting in the face of the Trump administration.
And if you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome.
part of what Congresswoman Maxine Waters said during a protest in Los Angeles this week. Those comments immediately sparked indignation across the political spectrum, really. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders referred to those comments kind of obliquely during a press conference on Monday. Listen.
We are allowed to disagree, but we should be able to do so freely and without fear of harm. And this goes for all people, regardless of politics. Some have chosen to push hate and vandalism against the restaurant that I was asked to leave from. A Hollywood actor publicly encouraged people to kidnap my children. And this weekend, a member of Congress called for people to push back and make clear to those serving their country and this administration that they are not welcome anywhere, anytime, for anything. Healthy debate on ideas and political philosophy is important, but the calls for harassment and push for any Trump supporter to avoid the public is unacceptable.
Part of what Press Secretary Sarah Sanders said earlier this week. Steve Clemens, how do you see this debate as it's been playing out in Washington in the last few days?
Well, I have to say I'm vexed because I'm someone who believes strongly in civility and engaging people you don't agree with and having that conversation. I'm one who led the battle against John Bolton's confirmation vote years ago in my blogging and was given a lot of credit for that not happening. I'll sit down with John Bolton any day and have a civil discussion about our differences in different views. And he's rather pugnacious in ways I think are pretty abhorrent to things. But I think that calling, as Maxine Waters did, for the kind of action she did is something that many people feel is necessary in responding to an administration and a president that they think has behaved uncivilly and called similarly for people perceive the president having called for harm to others. I think that we're in a time where the presidency and the White House wants the treatment and decorum of the prestige of the presidency without behaving presidential. And that has created this dilemma for those of us like myself. And it reminds me in some way of my feelings during the AIDS activism of the 1980s. I was very active and supportive of those efforts to try to get the Reagan administration to do more. But I was in the lane of politeness, of civility, of working within the system.
You're talking about organizations right, like the Gay Men's Health Crisis and ACT UP.
Yeah, and ACT UP LA was out there shutting down cities, shutting down transport, creating incredible pain to bring attention. And I'm at a point where, listening to Christine Fair, who's I'm a great fan of hers, I think we need both sides of the equation. I respect where she's at. It's not where I'm at. I still want to sit down with Sarah Sanders. I want to sit down with Christine Nielsen and have a discussion about the issues. But I think you need both sides of the equation.
Before I come back to you, Christine, because I'd love you to jump in on this, but I'll get to you in just one second. I did want to get to Todd Gitlin first for a little historical perspective and the way that civil discourse has existed in American engagement. I mean, you know, America's kind of a raucous country and has been since we were colonies. I mean, you know, forget about getting kicked out of a restaurant. We all know how Hamilton ended. You know, how much should we actually look at civility as a bedrock, as a foundational principle of America? Is that just kind of a Pollyanna, you know, revisionist history, or is that real?
Well, I forget who it was who said politics ain't beanbag. And the history is as you speak it. Democracies are noisy and disorderly. So I have no qualms about disorder as such, but I must say I find it something between hilarious and appalling that the supporters of a president who said about one protester during the campaign, I'd like to punch him in the face, and express nostalgia for the era when protesters would be carried out on stretchers, and complained we're not allowed to push back anymore, that's a quote, and then enthusiastically supported a sucker-punching supporter at a demonstrator outside a North Carolina event, saying the audience hit back, that's what we need a little bit more of. All of a sudden, we're so delicate. All of a sudden, we are so dismayed when people go out in public and express their views. I think I'm with Steve about having a nice chat with Sarah Huckabee Sanders, but I don't think she wants to have one with either him or me or many of the reporters whom she insults regularly. So the moral panic about suddenly people aren't being nice, suddenly people are using dirty words. What was it Mr. Trump called the various unspecified countries in the White House not so long ago?
That word
was
we're
a
not
word
say
that ended
NPR,
with holes.
Yeah.
Yes, no, we're not going to say it, but he did.
Right. Christine, I do want you to jump in before we have to go to break. I know we have to pause in a moment, but I'd like you to jump in before we pause.
Sure. I mean, civility, quite frankly, in the word of one L.A. editorial writer, is a weasel word that the GOP deploys to basically shield itself from criticism of its hateful policies. And I want to address very briefly one of the comments that the caller made before you began the show about we have to fix this with our vote. And I'm going to tell you why our vote isn't going to fix this. We are looking at a fixed fight. We need massive democratic reforms. I work on democratic reforms in places like Pakistan and Afghanistan. I hate to tell Americans, we are not a democracy, and our vote's not going to fix it. And I'm happy after the break to elaborate upon this. It's a fixed fight, and this is all we have, is protesting these fans of autocracy when we find them.
Yeah, I do want you to elaborate more on that, Christine, as we continue our conversation with Christine Fair, Steve Clemens, Carolyn Lukensmeyer, and Todd Gitlin. I'm Joshua Johnson, glad to be with you from Aspen Public Radio. You're listening to 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Discover Card. You check your email or social media all the time, but Discover asks, what about checking something as important as your credit score? Well, Discover makes it quick and easy with their credit scorecard, which is free for everyone, even if you're not a customer. See your FICO credit score and other important credit information. And once you know your score, you should check to see if your current credit card is the best fit for you. Learn more at discover.com/credit scorecard. Limitations apply.
July 2016, a woman calls 911.
We got that emergency.
She sees a man who she says looks mentally ill. And she says she thinks he's got a gun. Or at least something shaped like a gun. The police come, they shoot, but they shoot the wrong guy.
Organist hold fire.
Hear what happened on the Embedded podcast.
Glad to have heard from so many of you about civility in politics today. We also heard from a number of listeners who shared messages with us, listeners with very personal stakes in this debate.
Hi, Josh. It's Justin Magruder. I'm the son of Jeb Magruder, one of the Watergate conspirators. During the Watergate years was difficult as a child. I was 10, 11, 12 years old, and our family was physically and verbally assaulted many times in many places. At school, at restaurants, at sporting events, basically anywhere we went, people attacked us, and they physically attacked my father and me and my brothers and sister. And I think it's unfortunate. They were led to believe that that was appropriate by their leaders on the political left, and I think that's completely inappropriate. All it did was harden our positions. It didn't promote a better discourse, and I hope that people will learn from the mistakes of the past.
Justin, we really appreciate you sharing your story. Carolyn Lukensmeyer, talk a little bit from your perspective about where civil discourse was supposed to sit in our democracy. Did the founding fathers talk about civility or civil discourse at all?
Actually, Derek Webb, a Stanford law professor, wrote a great treatise on the original meaning of civility as it actually took place in the Constitutional Convention. And what he acknowledges is that there were two kinds of deliberation that took place, one of which was led by people like Madison and Adams, which was very open debate on topics in which there was a great level of grace and understanding, we have to explore this territory. The second kind of debate always took place in private, which were the really tough, tough issues that the founders knew could actually tear this apart. And their wisdom was to take that kind of debate out of the public process, have a smaller number of people really get to it in terms of what those differences were. And frankly, those same founding fathers built real conflicts into our Constitution, which we are still fighting about today. Federal power versus state power. The 2016 election really brought to a head the rural-urban differences in the country as we haven't seen them in decades. So one of the challenges of where we are today is that the word civility gets equated with politeness or gets equated with being nice to each other. Your last two callers, Justin McGruber, really said it beautifully around when people use really incivil, disrespectful behavior to attack another side, it just hardens the position of that other side. It doesn't bring about any change. And Bette was true, gives great examples in the big social movements in the country. They didn't happen out of a position of the way she was using the word civility. unfortunately, if we take the most current instance, what's gone on at the border, the total immorality, the injustice of the way children have been separated from their families, which has brought this surge of incivil behavior on the side of the left, what we have to understand is that us arguing about civility or incivility is really a deflection. Incivility is not going to fix this crisis. We have to get back to a place where we hold our elected officials on this specific issue accountable for introducing a piece of legislation which solves this problem yet this summer and puts a bill back on the president's desk.
This is exactly why what she proposes is absolutely correct if we had a functioning democracy. But what I would like to point out that we're not a functioning democracy in many ways, in part because of the things that our slave-owning, slave-raping, founding fathers, with emphasis on fathers, put into this Constitution. First, I want to make it very clear that those of us who are progressive, our vote counts less, and it's going to continue to count less. And in fact, the disparity in the value of our vote is going to increase over time in a number of ways. One, the slave state college, which is what some people call the electoral college, bakes this into it, right? We have gerrymandering. And if anyone thought our courts were going to protect us in our institution, I hope they were watching yesterday. Our courts are the product of depoliticization and, quite frankly, thefts of judicial appointments by Mitch McConnell and the previous administration. Our courts are deeply politicized in a way that are going to support the ongoing consolidation of power by an autocratic leader, not protect us from it. We have voter restrictions. And again, I go back to the court comment. They're not going to save us. And we have, I think, what's really unique in parliamentary democracies. Many parliamentary democracies have senates which have equal representation, but those senates tend to not have power. The Senate is extremely unrepresentative, and yet it holds most of the power to appoint judges, to confirm cabinet members. We are a deeply undemocratic country. And
so, Christine, I want to make sure I follow what you're getting at. I want to make sure I follow what you're getting at, that because of, it sounds like you're saying, because of inherent inequities that are baked into the system at a certain point, being polite don't cut it, that you have to push back in a different way outside of the system because the system isn't built to give equity. Is that what you're getting at?
That is exactly it. This is not a fixed fight. Now, very clearly, I want to make it clear that I don't support violence. When I confronted Richard Spencer in my gym, I wasn't shrieking. That was a very masculinist portrayal of what went down. I said to him very firmly, as a white person in this country, I think you are repugnant. Your values are repugnant. You're not welcome here in this community, and you're not welcome in this gym. It was actually, that was going to be the end of it. It was actually a two-prong situation. One was confronting him politely under the terms. I kept my hands to myself. There was never at any point any threat of violence. I myself do oppose violence. But the other issue, and I think this is also something that it has in common with the Red Hen episode, is that these places of employment have employees and they have rights. This isn't about Richard Spencer's rights or Ms. Huckabee Sanders' rights. It's about the rights of the employees. The employees told me, because they were my friends, that they asked the gym management to oust Mr. Spencer. The gym employees tended to be African American, women, and non-Christian. And the gym basically told them to suck it up if you want your job. So I made the case, again, forcefully, I have to say to a very unwoke gym manager, that if he did not oust Mr. Spencer from the gym, that I would help organize those employees in a class action suit by helping them find legal representation to file a class action suit based upon hostile environment. The owner of the Red Hen did not kick out Ms. Huckabee Sanders because of an arbitrary disagreement with Ms. Sanders, but rather because her employees, many of whom were LGBTQ, felt uncomfortable with her there. So I would like people to consider, in the case of a business transaction, the employees have legal rights that are prior to the feelings of the individuals. And why are they imposing a hostile environment? Because of the things they do and the things that they say.
should note that the president had continued tweeting about Maxine Waters, including this morning. This morning, the president wrote, quote, "Congratulations to Maxine Waters, whose crazy rants have made her, together with Nancy Pelosi, the unhinged face of the Democrat Party. Together, they will make America weak again. But have no fear, America is now stronger than ever before, and I'm not going anywhere." Steve Clemens, I wonder if there's another aspect of all this that we need to just kind of hit on the head. I think that raising your voice, shaking your fist, protesting, shouting someone down, blocking someone's entry, forcing someone to leave, feels good. Viscerally. It doesn't feel good to be nice and to squelch your feelings and go, okay, well, I guess I'll just hold on. I guess I'll just wait for November and take my anger to the ballot box again. There's no satisfaction in that. There's something visceral about just getting in someone's face and telling them what you think. And maybe that's also part of the equation, that we just need to get over this idea that we can remove people's human desire for vengeance.
Well, this takes me back to what I was talking about with ACT UP in Los Angeles. ACT UP was, frustrating cities and people. And, you know, we had the civility discussion back then, but ACT UP had a strategy. ACT UP had objectives. There were issues going on there. So it was more than the moment. I never want to. I have great admiration for what Christine did with Richard Spencer in one part of it. But on the other hand, I don't want to walk away from the notion, particularly as a journalist, in which I have, believe in a 360-degree discussion on many issues and maintaining an openness to others. I think America doesn't have – it has diminishing space in our civil society for – those kinds of discussions. We're dividing ourselves, we're buffering ourselves from each other. And I have to tell you, I have relatives in Kansas, Oklahoma, Texas, and Michigan, many of whom supported Donald Trump, and I try and understand where they're coming from. We're in very different places. I didn't, but I want to understand and know that, and I think many of my friends are losing patience with that process. So when you have that momentary impulse, when you have the red hen moment, you have something like that, yeah, it may feel good, but ultimately it has accomplished nothing. What Maxine Waters was suggesting, I think, is also impulse without purpose, in my view.
I hear you in terms of the ACT UP strategy. I think ACT UP's a really interesting example. You know, we've had Dr. Anthony Fauci on this program, who is basically the foremost expert on HIV and AIDS in America, and one of the foremost
huge
in the world.
Hero.
Right. And he was at the NIH during the advent of HIV. But these angry, loud, vile, disruptive, messy, literally messy with like fake blood protests saved lives.
Yes.
They probably helped protect me from HIV because they allowed for the advent of things like PrEP so that I can take a once daily pill and protect
myself.
And
they helped Tony Fauci move a recalcitrant bureaucracy that did not want to make these
changes.
And
he wasn't going to do it with a petition drive.
That's right.
It wasn't going to happen unless there were gay men in the street saying, we're here, we're queer, get used to it.
That's right.
Or who were falling down on the steps at Wall Street and demanding that companies invest money in treatments for HIV. Now, I hear you, but it saved lives.
That's right.
So do we look at that kind of incivil protest and say, well, I don't know. It saved lives.
Oh, no, I advocate. I advocate what ACT UP did.
So then why is that okay? So that's kind of what I'm wondering is how do we – can we extrapolate more categorically from something like ACT UP? And maybe Todd Gitlin, maybe let me let you jump in a second. Is there something we can extrapolate from the free speech movement at Berkeley, the ACT UP protests at the NIH, the sit-ins at lunch counters in the 50s and 60s? Is there a common thread there? Do the standards change over time?
Can we learn from the March on Washington of these young students about guns that has just been mesmerizing
and important?
The March
for Our Lives back in March.
When you see March for Our Lives, when you saw the reaction, which has been undone to some degree by the Supreme Court about the president's stand on Muslim flights and flights from various countries
the
around the country, people,
ruling.
The travel ban coming in. I think that these spontaneous protests have had a very big, but there's been a sense of organization, a sense of great purpose. I think the question right now, as we look at these individual moments, again, I was careful to say I understand where they come from.
Right.
I find them to be different than we've seen from the March for Our Lives. And I also want to make the claim that regardless of how Pollyannish it is, I believe we need more spaces for people of different backgrounds, different beliefs, different perspectives, which they feel passionately to come together and be able to have encounters. And we see less of that in this country, and we should be worried about
it. Todd Gitlin, let me let you
May
jump
I
in.
Have a bit of civility
well, let's get to Todd Gitlin first,
direction?
And then we'll keep going.
Thank you very much.
Todd, let's let you jump in.
Some tactics are very good for some purposes. ACT UP was brilliant at accomplishing a very specific goal. But what is being proposed now by some is a kind of expression of rage, which is not necessarily astute. It's not necessarily wrong. What Christine said before at the very beginning of her last remark is very important. And I would put it this way. Neither civility nor incivility will save us. The democracy is in crisis. Let's think just about this little fact. Two of the last three presidents, they happen to have been Republicans, were elected by less than a majority of the popular vote. A society in which that's the case cannot congratulate itself for its democratic achievement. It has to look seriously at the breakdown of institutions. So while we're debating whether somebody should say boo to somebody else, let's take an example of an immediate threat to democracy. It was reported yesterday that the major Silicon Valley companies met with intelligence officials about the threats that are looming before the midterm elections, threats from foreign intrusion, specifically from the Russians. And the takeaway from that meeting from the executives was that the U.S. government is not prepared to help safeguard the democratic process. Now, that is where the headlines ought to be. We're 4 months away from the midterm elections. That failure of democracy, along with all the other things that Christine itemized, those are the structural impediments to actually having a serious democratic conversation.
Plenty more to discuss as we continue this very civil conversation about civility in America today. Stay close.
Whether it's athlete protests, the Muslim travel ban, gun violence, school reform, or just the music that's giving you life right now, race is the subtext to so much of the American story. And on Code Switch, we make that subtext text. You can listen to us on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Back now to our conversation with Todd Gitlin of Columbia University, Carolyn Lukensmeyer of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, Christine Fair of Georgetown University's Security Studies Program, and Steve Clemens of The Atlantic. We'll get to more of your comments in just a moment, but I know Carolyn and Christine, you've been waiting very patiently to chime in. Let's hear from Carolyn and then Christine, and then we'll keep going. Carolyn?
Joshua, I want to bring in an aspect of this conversation that we haven't addressed yet. The level of stress in the country at the current kind of language that's been legitimated since Trump was a candidate in 2016, and as he's continued to be, as we've said earlier, misogynist, otherizing people, even disabled people, the public is now 75% of us really say that incivility is a crisis in the country, according to Weber Shandwick's poll on civility in America this year. The other poll data that I think your listeners need to know is that the American Psychological Association has done a Stress in America survey every year for the last 25 years. This year, something showed up that they've never seen before. The fourth highest level of stress was the current political climate at 57% of respondents. So what we've got to acknowledge is that incivility and the legitimization of bigotry that we are now experiencing is like a virus in this country. And if we don't do something about this at the person-to-person level, in families, in neighborhoods, in communities, then just shifting out what party is in charge, if we are still vilifying each other as people about who we voted for and which position we hold on immigration or which position we hold on the border, this really has to be dealt with as a social phenomena. In fact, public health is now willing, the American Association of Public Health is now willing to say that incivility is actually a causative factor in disease. So we have to, this isn't just about the big issues and what Maxine Waters does. This is really about we, the American people, are not supported in coming back into the capacity to talk and listen with one another in a way that recognizes our core humanity.
Christine Fair, let me give you a chance to jump in before we get to some more audience comments. Christine?
Yeah. So I couldn't. In fact, I am stressed out hearing this. If your listeners are not stressed out, they are not paying attention. This is not a debate over arcane nuances in preferred tax policies. We have one party that is actively supporting white supremacy. And by the way, the premise that if we just talk nicely to them, that they're going to come around and see that they're racist and change their behavior. Speaking of studies, that has been resoundingly trounced repeatedly. And in fact, Trump supporters prefer autocracy because they know that autocracy will protect their white privilege. It's only by enfranchising non-white people that white supremacy comes under challenge. So I'm glad that we are stressed, but you are confusing cause and effect. The stress should be a result of our democracy under attack, and some of us want to fight that, and some of us want to support this. And going back to the superb point that Todd Gitlin's made, our entire democratic infrastructure is obsolete. I don't want to have a discussion about civility or incivility. I want us to have a discussion about how do we make our non-democratic country an actual democracy. The GOP is perfectly happy to steal our democracy because they already have. The GOP is not going to willingly change gerrymandering, the slave state college, the fact that the Senate has all the power but is overwhelmingly not representative of voters. And marches don't fix anything. What marches do, people buy the T-shirt and they say that march was great. Well, if you look at countries where their voters are actually ticked off about something their autocratic government is doing, they will occupy the government for days. I am calling for massive civil disobedience. If we want our democracy back, we cannot be bought off. I actually almost laughed at the idea that there are firms wanting to get their productivity back up because they know that if we are vested in our jobs, we will not go onto the street. We will not demand change. And if we want democracy, we have to be willing to fight for it. Our troops aren't fighting for our freedom. They are not. I'm tired of hearing that, canard. If we want our democracy, we need to occupy every Trump hotel. We need to have die-ins on the Hill. We need to raise the social cost of being a fascist in this country, and we cannot take this laying down.
Let me piece apart, Christine, what you just said, because I hear there are two things that I wonder if they need to be taken kind of side by side. The civil disobedience aspect, and then this idea that, you know, if you're not stressed out, you're not paying attention. I understand on the civil disobedience aspect, I mean, one of the plans that Martin Luther King Jr. had before he was assassinated 50 years ago this April was for a major sit-in on the National Mall to advocate for poor people. It's part of what would have been his next major move, the Poor People's Campaign. So I understand the idea about civil disobedience. I do, however, want to ask you about the stress, about the tone. It's this idea that if you're not stressed out, you're not paying attention. This may sound like a really facile question, and I'm not trying to ask a stupid question, but does stressing out help? Do you gain anything from stressing yourself out, or would it behoove you to find ways to be just as civilly disobedient with a level head?
I have a level head. What I'm calling for is actually level. I'm not going to engage in this conversation of civility over incivility. I want to engage in the issues that Todd Gitlin also raised, that we are in a – we don't have a civility crisis here, people. We have a democracy crisis. So it's a little bit like, you know, oh, we're going to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic as we watch this thing sink. No. My stress motivates me every day to use my white privilege. When I see people engaging in racist, obnoxious behavior, I'm going to call them on it. My stress is what keeps me going. It's what keeps me alert. It's what keeps my eye on the real prize, which isn't this bogus discussion of should we be nice to people that are literally ripping children out of the arms of infants out of the arms of their mothers? That's not the debate. Folks, we need to be debating how do we get our country into a democracy? How do we get those reforms that make us a democracy when we are confronting a system that is stacked and a political party that knows exactly what it's doing, the GOP? And moreover, we are talking about the Trump's base, which is fact-resistant, mobilized by fear. And there have been countless psychological studies on the profile of a Trump voter and why they're so respondent to fear. Right?
Let's be careful about not painting people with too broad a brush.
No,
some of those folks are in our audience and want to empathize with what you have to say.
I'm talking about
hold on, everybody stop. Because See, this is where civility starts. It starts and ends with me. I'm in charge of this conversation, so everybody stop. Let's be careful about painting anyone with a broad brush. I totally understand the anger that you bring to this. I hear your frustration. Do not categorize people that broadly. I don't think it helps, and I think a lot of those folks are in our audience, and I'm trying to be an advocate. I'm trying to hear you,
sir,
but I'm trying to make sure we advocate for everybody in our audience. So just, you're skirting up to a line, Christine. I just need you to pull back a little. Do you hear me?
I want you to hear me, because you misheard me. I am talking about various psychological studies of specific voter profiles. I am not painting anyone with a brush. Statistical studies talk about median and average persons.
That's what profiling is.
So you completely accepted other psychological studies that were proffered by other members on this panel, but when I talk about psychological studies that talks about a different profile, all of a sudden that's upsetting. There have been psychological studies are scientific. My premise is this. We have multiple studies about psychology of different voter profiles. These are scientific. These are not eugenic. And we know that some kinds of voters are more motivated by, for example, evidence. They're more willing to change their views. Other kinds of voters are not. Now, this isn't painting anyone with a brush in a pejorative way. These are simply facts of how people respond to different kinds of treatments. And what consistent studies have shown about the average Trump voter is that they are less motivated by things like science. In fact, they're more likely than non-Trump voters to say global warming is bogus, evolution is bogus. So this isn't a normative discussion. This is simply what scientific studies have shown motivates different groups of voters. So if we have a group of voters who on the margin, which is what studies, this is the language that they use, are not motivated by facts and reason, this is a fake argument that we're having about civility. Right. This doesn't match the treatment. And moreover, the real discussion isn't civility or incivility. It should be our lack of democracy and our inability at the ballot box to make those changes. That's the real discussion. This isn't, you know, are Democrats this or Republicans that? Is that our system is fixed and
we don't. I have to cut you off there, Christine. Let me pull this conversation back on track. I hear you, Christine, that is your frustration. The mainstream of this conversation, for the minutes that we have left, has to do with civility, particularly because I think part of the idea behind civility, and I'm not negating that there are real problems with democracy. I mean, our union was designed to be made more perfect. So, Christine, I hear you. Part of the goal behind discussing civility is this idea, and, you know, Carolyn, correct me if I'm wrong, that there is a common set of standards that regardless of your politics or your background or your psychological profile, that we can be the land of E Pluribus Unum, that we can be one democracy, one republic that can set a common set of rules of the road for one another. We don't all have to agree, but we need one set of driving rules so that the democracy doesn't turn into a constant game of bumper cars. And I'm feeling more frustrated now at the end of this conversation that is less and less possible, even though the people who have these frustrations, like you, Christine, have really legitimate reasons for being ticked off. I totally hear you. But I don't know if this is getting us to a place where we can solve the problems we have. So, moderator's privilege, where do we go from here? Let's just refocus the conversation on where we go from here and what the future looks like in the immediate days. And let's just take the next few months and years, where we go from here as a democracy. Todd Gitlin, I haven't heard from you in a while. Let me come to you briefly before we have to wrap up. Where do we go from here with this?
Defeat the Republican Party. This is not an even-handed, this is not an equally balanced horror that we're confronting. We're facing a party that is unscrupulous in its seeking and acquisition of power, that prevented a vote for most of a year on a Supreme Court justice, that refuses to address even constituents of Republican congressmen. They don't want to talk to them anymore in town meetings. That cuts off debate. That is colluding with Fox News and Sinclair to broadcast what's essentially state propaganda.
So this is not created by the problem.
Let me just one more thing.
Well, we're short on time. You got to be quick.
I was quick. I was touched by what young Magruder, sorry, I forgot his name, Justin, said before. But one thing about that, he was mistaken. He was mistaken in saying that the Democratic left invoked, invited, provoked attacks on his family. That didn't happen. That didn't happen. But we have a different situation today in which we have a president who called, who excited what he called the Second Amendment people. Remember that? He's invited, he was worried about whether the Second Amendment people would get out of hand confronting Hillary Clinton. This is not coming from the Democratic Party. This is coming from a racist, nativist party, as Christine says. It is at fault, and the only way to address it, in my view, is to defeat them.
Carolyn Lukensmeyer, very briefly, where do we go from here?
Well, this is pretty challenging in terms of there isn't any question but what the Trump administration has a troubling relationship with the truth, that evades any kind of challenge, it undermines the Constitution. But we're a country of 330 million people, many of whom are Republicans who don't actually carry the feelings that the strategy that Todd and Christine have been describing. The people who are listening to us, I am sure in some ways many of them feel like now they need a chance to have their voice heard. So where we have to go from here is we have to, yes, recognize protest as a long-term viable part of American democracy that has brought significant social change, which we would not have without it. Mm. It is also true that the way in which compromise legislation comes out of the U.S. Congress is, for example, Patty Murray and Lamar Alexander working on several education bills while everything else was crumbling around them. Steve spoke eloquently about this. We need both voices of protest that have specific organized targets, but we need the capacity to talk to each other and demand that our elected officials who are holding this power talk to each other and find a way forward.
Carolyn Lukensmeyer of the National Institute for Civil Discourse, Steve Clemens of The Atlantic, Christine Fair of Georgetown University's Security Studies Program, and Todd Gitlin of Columbia University. Appreciate all of your views and insights. Thanks very much for joining us. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.